This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The mass shootings 1 week ago at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, left 50 people dead and dozens more wounded and plunged that country into mourning. The massacre also sent shockwaves through the Muslim community here in the United States. A week on from the massacre, thousands of people gathered at vigils in New Zealand to remember the victims of the attack and show solidarity with the survivors. Vigils here in the United States also paid tribute to the victims. And in Orlando, the site of the Pulse nightclub shooting nearly 3 years ago, there's a sense of shared grief. So what's been the response from the faith communities? What effect does an attack on a house of worship have on a community's sense of security? We're taking your calls and your comments and questions. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. And you can reach out to us on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining me in the studio, Imam Tariq Rashid. He's the Imam and President of the Islamic Center of Orlando. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also joined by Rabbi David Kay. He's with the congregation Ohev Shalom in Maitland. Rabbi Kay, thank you as well.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And you can join the conversation as well. The number is 1-866-338-5252. Reach out to us with your comments and questions on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. Imam Tariq, I want to just first kind of get your reaction and tell me how the week has been. What, first of all, went through your mind when you heard about the shooting in New Zealand? This was sort of breaking news on Thursday evening last week.
Yes, on Thursday evening last week, when I first heard about it, I did not understand the full scope of the destruction and the killing. But as the nights unfolded, by morning time, it became evident what exactly has happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And since the next day was Friday, and Friday is our service day, so a sense of insecurity was there in my mind and in the mind of nearly every worshipper. So our first job was to make sure that the Friday services happen with complete peace and, no unfortunate incident takes place. So, thanks for the Orlando, for Orange County Sheriff Department and Orlando Police that, they came and they guarded our mosque. And, we have nearly 1,200 people who come out every Friday to my mosque to worship.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was a huge crowd and, everything went peacefully.
But is this the biggest mosque in the Central Florida area?
Yes, I would say so, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is why, we were concerned that such a big crowd and everybody was shaken up, everybody was aggrieved. And, so that sermon was very important for me. That moment was very important to me. I wanted to instill the feeling of security in the heart of the worshippers, and the fact that I want to make sure that they don't change the schedule of coming to the mosque, and they should continue to come as they have been coming for years. And the youth and the women and men, everybody should come, keep coming as they are coming, and they should not be fearful of coming to the mosque. So that mm-hmm. was a big challenge. So far, so good. But yes, the community is still very grieved.
Kind of what were you thinking as you were thinking about what you were going to tell the folks coming to service on Friday? Like how did you approach that speech? Because you're right. I mean, that's an important moment for you. You have to reassure the folks who come to worship there. You have to kind of make sure that they feel safe.
Yeah.
What do you tell them?
So what I told them was that, unfortunately we are living in a world where not only just mosque, but every place of worship is under threat. And there are so many instances, unfortunate incidents that happened, like Pittsburgh a few months ago. So many Jews who were worshiping there, they were killed. Then go back a year ago in Texas, another 50 people were killed in a Christian church.
You're talking about Sutherland Springs.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see these sometimes school shootings, sometimes mall shooting. So, unfortunately, we are living in a place where, people have easy access to arms, and many of them have hatred, and sometimes just out of depression, people are doing all kind of crazy things. So my job was to tell them that, you know, this is the kind of world, unfortunately, we are living in. But we must not change the way we are worshiping, the way we are coming to the mosque. This should not deter them from coming.
Well, Rabbi David Kaff, I could bring you into the conversation now. What was your response? What was your reaction to news of the shooting, the tragedy back in New Zealand?
As a community, of course, we were horrified and saddened. And that Shabbat morning, on Saturday morning at our regular weekly Sabbath service, I wasn't sure what to say to my congregation. You know, it evokes memories, of course, of Pittsburgh in mm-hmm. back in December. Certainly, it evokes memories of the Pulse shooting here 3 years ago, almost now. And like the imam, I wanted my congregation to feel both that they were in a safe place, that they shouldn't disrupt their lives because of what people with hate in their hearts decide to do, because that's exactly what the people with hate in their hearts want you to do. They want you to disrupt your life. I also wanted to make sure that we had a sense of empathy with those other congregations, those other communities, those faith communities that were suffering as we had just a few months before. So I really just, you know, came out from behind the pulpit and walked out into the congregation, and we just had a conversation, and it went very well. It was I think it was very, very sincere. Wanted to reassure people that a house of worship is still a place of refuge. It's still a place where you disconnect from the outside world. You connect with people who want to support you, who love you, who care about you, and that an isolated incident like we had just heard about is not the norm. And the people who commit those are not the norm. We saw that here in Orlando after Pulse, the outpouring of support. We saw it after the Tree of Life shooting, the outpourings of support. I was living in New York, in Manhattan, in September of 2001, and I saw an entire city, which is notorious for saying, you know, it's not my problem, I don't care about anybody else, I'm just doing my own thing.
Right, it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it, the kind of New York attitude.
Exactly.
Just keep walking.
Yeah. And, you know, the week before I had seen somebody, you know, who wouldn't pull over to the curb to let to let an ambulance by because he was afraid he was going to lose his place in line. And a week later, I saw people who were just pouring out all kinds of, you know, all kinds of wonderful, compassionate things. Unfortunately, it takes tragedy to bring that out in en masse in people. I think our goal is, as faith leaders, certainly, I'm sure, is to bring that out in people all the time.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking about what happens, how the faith community responds when there's an attack on a house of worship, talking about what happened in New Zealand a week ago. We're with Imam Tariq Rashid with the Islamic Center of Orlando and Rabbi David Kaye with the congregation Ohev Shalom in Maitland. You can join the conversation as well. I want to know what your thoughts are. Has the shooting back in New Zealand kind of shaken your faith at all, or other recent tragedies visited on faith communities? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. We're also over on Twitter. You can reach out to us at WMFE Orlando. Well, Rabbi Kay, walk us back to what happened in December last year. I mean, this hit home not only because, of course, it's a synagogue that was attacked, but also there are some connections between the folks in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh and here in Orlando too, right?
Yeah, several of my congregants have connections to Squirrel Hill. Grew up there. It was it still is a large and vibrant Jewish community, and so there was a very personal sense of loss there as well. You know, the interfaith memorial that was held here in Orlando featured a couple of folks who were reminiscing about what that community was really like. It was difficult to, again, it was difficult to speak to it. Mm-hmm. And obviously, especially because it was something that impacted on the Jewish community, my congregation was very much waiting to hear what I had to say. And, you know, in response, you know, I could only echo the voices of those people who had, you know, who had gone through that experience.
Mm-hmm.
A number of people who came to the synagogue specifically in on that Shabbat morning, on that Saturday morning, Sabbath morning, immediately following, just to get the sense of community, people we hadn't seen before, people actually who were from Pittsburgh. We had one person who was traveling through Orlando and needed to be someplace and needed to feel the sense of community and support and just showed up to, mm-hmm. To try and get that in our congregation.
Mm-hmm. Got a comment coming in from Brandon on Twitter. Brandon writes, "Assalamu alaikum. I was devastated by the shooting and the hate shown in New Zealand and have made it my goal to show love and friendship to every person of any background I meet throughout my day. My heart aches for our brothers and sisters that have hate and fear thrown in their faces every day just because of their religion and culture." Imam Rashid, coming back to you for a moment. So what has the response been from folks in the community over the last week? I know that some mosques have made an effort to say, look, our doors are open. If you have questions, if you want to come chat, we're here. Come talk to us. Have you sort of had that same response from folks just expressing some concern, some sympathy, maybe more interest in the Islamic community here in Orlando?
Yes. Last Sunday, the Islamic Center of Orlando organized an interfaith memorial. It was attended by hundreds of people of all faiths and no faiths. So it went very well, where we heard words of support and sympathy from people coming from all walks of life. So that was very good. And but at the same time, you know, we have been receiving lots of, you know, emails and messages and letters in mail, cards of sympathy in mails, and flower bouquets are coming by mail to our mosque and from people that we do not know. And they have written some wonderful things. So, you know, these things are really moving for us. And these things are actually helping us, you know, get rid of the grief that we have. You know, I mean, the grief will be there for a long time, yes, but, you know, this support from the community is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that is continuing. I mean, just last night, I received a wonderful card with handwritten message, long message of sympathy from a person that I do not know. And he is Christian. He said that he's Christian, but what he wrote was wonderful. It was moving. So, and I have many, many emails of this sort. So these actions of support means a lot to the Muslim community of Orlando.
On the flip side of that, do you also see a bit of an uptick in folks who do not have that support, who are saying, you know, maybe more hateful things online or even in person?
Yes, sometimes that happens as well. But I would say this time, I have not received any hateful message so far.
Mm-hmm.
All the messages that I have received are of sympathy and support. That is good.
Got a call coming in now from Eric. Eric, you're on the line. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've been following all of the news and especially any of the hate crimes and mass shootings, you know, for ever since Sandy Hook. I'm a medical doctor. I'm a psychiatrist. And it's just so painful to see the kind of country that we've become. We started out as a representative democracy, welcoming people from every faith and every country in the world. And we've turned into this country that's incredibly intolerant. And there's this sort of undercurrent of, well, if you're not Christian, if you're not, you know, democratic, you know, then you're not, you're an evildoer. You're someone who could, you know, isn't really worth anything. And I think there's a lot of that online. There's a lot of that in social media. There's a lot of people who feel like that's, they're entitled to that belief that, you know, if you're a Muslim, you're not welcome. If you're black, you're not welcome. If you're from another country, you're not welcome. If you're Jewish, you're not welcome. And that's just, that there's no religious test to be an American. There's no, can't welcome and embrace, you know, every religious, ethnic, and racial group in the world. That's what made America great once upon a time. But I think we're definitely losing that status.
So you'd like to see intolerance. You'd like to see America make its way back to that. Well, I mean, how do you kind of cope with that, Eric? What's your response? What's your kind of coping strategy then?
Well, I think the basic tenet of most major religions, if you look at the bottom line, is the same. Whether it's Jewish, whether it's Muslim, whether it's Christian, it's right in the Ten Commandments. It's doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. Mm-hmm. It's being kind, just like this speaker was saying. When there's no problem, people are very selfish. But as soon as there's a crisis, then people come together. And we should be like that all the time, because you never know when you're going to need help, mm-hmm. And people need help all the time. And instead of constantly thinking about ourselves and making our world smaller and smaller, thinking about, well, what's it like to be the other guy? What's it like to be the other in someone else's shoes? Mm-hmm. And, the gifts that we give to ourself is really what we give to others. That helps us as much or more as it helps the other person.
Well, Eric, thanks so much for calling in and sharing your thoughts there. Rabbi David Kaff, I could throw that question to you, or that thought to you, rather. I mean, it sounds a little bit like Eric's expressing some of what, as he was saying, you sort of said you saw in the aftermath of 9/11, a community coming together, but why can't we be like this all the time? And I'm wondering if maybe that's the answer, or could be one of the answers to trying to circumvent some of these tragedies before they happen next time around.
Yeah, there was about the only philosophy that I've ever really studied was a French Jewish philosopher named Emmanuel Levinas, and he took religious leaders to task because they didn't practice what they preached. In a conference that took place several years after the end of World War II, he said, we've all gotten up here and said that, we should have done more and we could have done more. I think that we need to take more responsibility. We need to say, if we would have done what we say that we believe, the horrible things that happened could never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think people of faith, people of conviction, people of goodwill, which is most people, are going to have to step up a little bit. But I think we also have to remember that this is something, a very important lesson that came in the aftermath of Pulse for me was, at a couple of the funerals of people who were killed at Pulse, there were, I don't want to dignify them by calling them protesters, but there were hateful people,
sure,
who showed up, a small number, 3 or 4, and there were 100 times that number of people who came to make sure that the people who were grieving were screened and protected from those couple of hateful people.
Mm-hmm.
That's really my model for the way that I think our society really is. You can get a lot of attention by acting out. We learn that when we're toddlers. By the time we're adults, we should have gotten over that and not feel the need to act out to get attention or to get our cause noticed or to have our voice be heard. So maybe good people have to act out a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Imam Tariq Rashid, among the victims in Christchurch were children, the youngest 4 years old. I understand there are still some kids who are, fighting for survival from that attack. I'm wondering if you've had questions from some of the younger members of your mosque. How could this happen? And how do you reassure kids? What do you say to them?
Yes, this 4-year-old child who was killed, that news really hit hard here, like every other place. So our children at our Islamic center, they have these questions. So it's hard to answer these questions because 4-year-old child, innocent child, why was he killed? But then again, the answer to that is that, you know, hate does not need any common sense. Hate is just an act of craziness. And whether it's a woman, child, or old, or young man, the hate just wants to express its hatred, or its hatred by killing and hurting as many people as possible. So, you know, you cannot make any common sense out of it. It's just plain hate. But talking about hatred, you know, I would like to say that the Orlando community is a very blessed community because here we have faith leaders who meet on a regular basis. And we have tremendous love and respect towards each other. After Pearl shooting, you know, we saw that. It was Ramadan time. And I can tell you, you know, Rabbi Kay's here and other Jewish leaders came for iftar, for Ramadan iftar at my mosque. Christian leaders came. You know, so we had meals together right after that. They came to ensure us that, you know, we are not to be blamed by the act of this one guy at Pearl shooting. Similarly, when this Christchurch incident happened, you know, the Jewish community and their leaders, rabbis, and the Christian community and their priests and pastors, all of them reach out to me and, you know, just to assure that, you know, they are with me and the Muslim community. So, and the reason for that is that we meet each other on a regular basis. We don't wait for a tragedy to happen to meet. We meet in good times. So when bad time comes, we know that my friend needs support right now or his community needs support. So we already have that connection before any tragedy happens. So I think the Orlando, you know, community is very blessed from this respect as well, that mm-hmm. we have interfaith leaders who have good relationship all year long.
There must be, though, David Kay, a sense of, oh no, not again. Like every time something like this happens, you must be thinking, here we go again, right? I mean, how do you kind of counteract that?
One of the most challenging things for people of goodwill and especially for people of faith who have to explain it within the context of our faith tradition is the inevitability of the next time. That's not an exciting thought. That's not an uplifting thought. It's the fact of life. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, oh no, not again. And it's sort of you know, you wake up and you look at the news headlines and, you know, you find out that 5 mosques in England were vandalized overnight. And you say, at least no one was injured, which is really kind of lowering the bar for for society to say, well, you know, they destroyed property and sent hateful letters, but at least no one was injured.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping that perspective that the folks who do that are being disproportionately represented in the public eye, and keeping in mind that the vast majority of people are horrified and disgusted by that kind of behavior, is the thing that's the message we have to keep bringing to the public, bringing to our congregants, bringing to our communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rabbi David Kay is with the congregation Ohev Shalom in Maitland. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
We're also joined by Imam Tariq Rashid. He is the Imam and President of the Islamic Center of Orlando. Imam Tariq, thank you as well.
Thank you for inviting.
Up next, maintaining a flawless complexion isn't as easy as you might think for a waxwork model. We'll meet the newest member of the lineup at Madame Tussauds Orlando and find out what it takes to keep the models looking good. And later in the show, a conversation with Eric and Colin Jacobson about brotherhood, rivalry, and the power of music to bring people together. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Doing a radio interview with someone who doesn't say a word can be tricky. One of my guests this week was, shall we say, the strong silent type. Fortunately, The Flash, the newest addition to Madame Tussauds Orlando, didn't come to the studio alone. Jade Sparks is the marketing manager for Madame Tussauds and Sea Life Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Erin Ruth is studio artist with Madame Tussauds. Thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you for having me.
Jade, I want to start with you. Most of the figures you have in your display are based on real people, right?
Yes. So all of our figures, whether historical or current celebrities, superheroes, they're all based off of someone iconic that has reached that star status that we want to commemorate or put into our attraction so guests can come and see them, where you in real life you might not get that opportunity, but with us you can.
So is it typical to have a fictional character rather than like a real person?
So we are very lucky, the fact that we have our Justice League experience. Not all Madame Tussauds have this. And as a matter of fact, our attraction in Orlando and our Madame Tussauds in Sydney were the only two in the entire Madame Tussauds estate to have this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So we're lucky to have all five now of the Justice League characters. So it's really exciting.
Okay, Erin Ruth, tell me about your job. This must be fascinating. You're in charge of maintaining the exhibits at Madame Tussauds?
Yes, we are. Yeah, we make sure throughout the day, in the mornings before we open, we walk around the attraction, make sure everyone's hair is in place, fix any damages that have occurred to the wax throughout the previous day, which means, you know, melting wax, fixing any scratches, painting with oil paint, any places that might need that, shining their eyes, combing their hair, styling their hair if they need extra product, or at the end of a walkthrough to come and just give a little extra attention to certain figures that might need it.
How do you train for a job like this?
It's different. You learn a lot while you're doing it. I have a background in portraiture, so the human figure is something I already knew a lot about. But now to take it to three dimensions, you're able to, I don't know, see the colors in a different way that you had ever seen it before. So it's a lot of we're learning as you do it.
Is there like a toolbox you have, like a little blowtorch or something and some paints? Like what is it, what is in your kit that you do the touch-up with?
Well, in my apron on a daily basis, I will have a wood tool, I'll have a metal tool, I'll have a lighter in order to warm up wax if I need to. I'll have a palette full of oil paint, paintbrushes of any particular size that we might need, turpentine to remove any shine that might have accumulated on the figures, and any matter of hair products and combs and brushes and tools all over the place.
Wow. So this is like you're a full body artist, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
Think of the top to the toe.
Jade of many trades. Yeah.
So tell me, Jade, what kind of response or what kind of characters do you get the biggest response from? Does it tend to be like real life people, or does it tend to be more the fictional characters like the Flash that you have now?
So all of our Justice League characters do give a lot of excitement, mainly because when you go into the experience, you're completely transported into Gotham City and Metropolis. And each one of the figures has an interaction, which is unlike anything in our attraction. So Flash, for example, you'll get to run alongside him in place. So it's about hitting your target speed, which Flash is the fastest man alive, so might not get to his speed, but you can hit your own target speed. And that will trigger this entire projection scene where lights will come around and just something that is so unique to Flash and the Justice League experience. So that always gets people really pumped up because you're now a part of the saga of the Justice League.
So there's a treadmill next to the Flash?
Not quite a treadmill. Some secret motion detector.
But you just have to run in place?
Yep. Mm-hmm. So each figure has something that, you know, maybe it's triggered by a sensor. You know, Superman, you lift a helicopter with him, so his figure moves up and down, which is totally unique to our attraction in Madame Tussauds. So guests get really excited about that. People do get really excited to see some of our historical figures. So coming in and seeing Martin Luther King Jr., we have Walt Disney, Albert Einstein. He just got a new sweater this week, so he's fresh.
Okay, Albert Einstein has kind of crazy hair, Erin. Do you just have to make sure it doesn't look too tidy? Is that the trick with Albert Einstein?
Yeah, it's a mixture of tidiness and messiness. You want to style it so it looks larger than life, but you want to make sure it's still going to hold throughout the day.
Which characters are the ones you have to do the most work on? I imagine there are some that are more popular than others, and people might be trying to touch them more than other characters.
It does seem that the seated figures are those that might receive the most attention and love by the guests. So those tend to seem, you know, to be the ones who might need a little more attention from us in the mornings.
What about the idea of waxworks in Florida? Like, what if there were a power cut or something? Do you have some backup generators to make sure everything doesn't melt?
Yes, we do. We do have backup generators. And with the aquarium next door, you know, we have a lot of safety measures and backup things to make sure that nothing happens to any of the figures, all of our sea creatures that we have. So we have lots of protocols in place for that. So hasn't happened, knock on wood.
And how often do you swap out the figures?
It depends. So sometimes, you know, with maintenance that the studio's team is doing, we may move around some of our figures so some can come off the floor. You know, for example, Neymar, who's a popular Brazilian soccer player, he's on the floor right now in a new place, so David Beckham can come off the floor and get some extra love and get him back into place. Because also our wax figures, some of them, their hair is real human hair, so it has to be washed and maintained, you know, just like a human hair might need done up. So like today, Aaron got some washing of David Beckham's hair.
David Beckham, back when he was playing, his hair was kind of the subject of headlines, right? I mean, when he was playing in the World Cup, like people would be copying his hairstyle. What sort of hair does he have these days?
Oh, it's very long. Similar to what he had then.
It's longer, so it kind of has that iconic David Beckham hairstyle.
And how do you wash a waxwork figure's hair? Do you have to pop the head off and stick it in a tub? How does that all work?
We do wash it in a sink, wash his hair in a sink like you would any like your own hair, and just run water over it, shampoo it with every product you would use on your own hair. And he's in conditioning right now as we speak.
Right. So how much of the figure is actually made of wax?
From the most part, it's about from your bust line up is wax. The rest of the body is fiberglass.
You spend a few minutes in our studio just now putting the flash together. Is that tricky?
It can be, depending on the figure. It just depends on how the hand placement is and depending on the head. And it just varies from figure to figure how easy or how difficult they might be.
So you're touring this guy around at the moment now. Have you developed a system for breaking him down and putting him back together again?
Yeah. He's actually quite on the simpler end of things, to be honest.
Yeah. We took Aquaman, so he's in our Justice League experience now. So we launched him back in December in line with the film, which was amazing. But we actually took him to New York City to be a part of the Aquaman movie, you know, press conference that they were having. And so he was probably a more complicated one because he has his trident and he's a little bit of a, no offense to the Flash, but a little bit of a buffer guy, more of a man's stance, as we like to say. So he was a little more complicated to move.
Who actually builds the figure in the first place? Is that you folks, or does it made somewhere else and then it shipped to you and you work on the maintenance of it?
It is, yes. They're all made in London by Merlin Magic Making, and then they are delivered to us, and we maintain them from there.
And is there like a guidebook that comes with each one?
Yes.
Here's how he's supposed to look, or she, and here's what you need to do if things start to go a little bit awry.
Yes, yeah, we do have a maintenance file that comes with images from every angle of the finished figure, and then all of the reference images that they use to create the figure, notes and such like that. If we have any issues, we can also contact them.
And do you have any control over what you display, or does that all come from Madame Tussauds in London?
Yeah, so actually the Justice League experience was an idea that locally our team on site kind of came up with. And we presented the concept to our brand and went forward from there. So we do get to, you know, come up with these ideas. And obviously being in Orlando and knowing who our consumer is and who our guest is, you know, we always want to cater to what's going to excite them and, you know, make them excited to come visit us. So we definitely get a good amount of say in what goes into our attraction. And Justice League is a prime example of that. I think it all started as a drawing on a piece of paper and then now it's a complete full, amazing experience. It was such a thing to be proud of for our team and to see it keep growing. I think I said five earlier, but there's actually six in the Justice League. So we have Obviously, kind of the key ones that we originally launched with, which is Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, Ben Affleck as Batman, and Henry Cavill as Superman. And then we have Jason Momoa as Aquaman, and then adding Ezra Miller as The Flash and Ray Fisher as Cyborg. That was something that started out as a small concept on paper, and through I don't even know how many people worked on this from start to finish, but it was completely brought to life, and it all started here in Orlando as an idea.
Are there any special requests you get from the audience? Like, does anybody would say, okay, it's fine having superheroes, but we'd really like to see some villains like the Joker or somebody like that?
Actually, yeah. Recently, we got a few Catwoman, so she was requested a few times. But we also, you know, we'll get people who will ask for, you know, all types of different celebrities. I think even some characters like SpongeBob. Mm-hmm. I think I saw that one on the list one time. So it's such a wide array of what people look for, but we're always looking at that and seeing what we can make work in our attraction.
Erin, Ruth, who's on your wish list? Who would you like to see?
Oh, gosh. I have a preference for some of the older set, and I would be thrilled if we had someone like Cary Grant or Frank Sinatra.
What kind of experience do you think you would design to go with that?
I would love to see like an old Hollywood portion of the attraction. We already have Audrey Hepburn, but I would just be thrilled to see a classic film.
I'm taking notes.
I'm looking forward to seeing that come to fruition at some point down the track. Well, Jade Sparks is the marketing manager for Madame Tussauds in Sea Life Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Erin Ruth. She is the studio artist with Sea Life and Madame Tussauds Orlando. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Still to come, brotherhood, music, and sporting rivalry. A conversation with Colin and Eric Jacobson. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit a conversation with the Jacobson brothers. Eric Jacobson is the music director and conductor of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra. His older brother Colin is a violinist. They have a long association with cellist Yo-Yo Ma and his ensemble Silk Road, and last May they reunited to perform Brahms' Concerto for Violin and Cello with the Orlando Philharmonic. I sat down for a conversation with Colin and Eric Jacobson about performing together and competing across the ping pong table. Colin began by talking about how the Brahms Concerto resonates with audiences today.
I actually think the piece is very much about brotherhood, or brotherhood, sisterhood, in a kind of embrace of humanity. And I mean, the backstory, as I understand it, is that Brahms and the violinist, the Hungarian Jewish violinist Joachim, you know, had a lifelong friendship, and Brahms wrote his violin concerto and his sonata so much for Joachim, but they had a falling out at one point, and this piece was, in a way, Brahms's homage to Joachim, and said, let's bring back our friendship. And you hear, I hear a narrative in the piece of conflict being mended and coming back together. And since, as Eric said, it's very much a violin and cello duo, as well as a very symphonic work where the orchestra is also expected to bring their best, you know, to the game. It has this sense of grandeur that is really amazing. But then, you know, grandeur set with intimacy of these two particular voices, violin and cello.
Well, let me ask you a personal question then. Have you ever had like a kind of a falling out with your brother that you've had to use music to, you know, heal that rift?
I think not in that big picture way that Brahms and Joachim had, where they weren't talking. I mean, we have micro falling outs all the time, you know, and always it's within music. So I certainly relate to that, of course. And I think there's another element that we were thinking about recently, you know, in terms of Brahms' world versus our own, in that Joachim was a Hungarian violinist. There was another Hungarian violinist that Brahms toured with. And, he, of course, his famous Hungarian dances, which amongst the most popular things Brahms ever wrote, he became obsessed with that around the time when there was a stream of Hungarian refugees in the city of Hamburg, where Brahms grew up. So somewhat of a similar parallel to today, where you have Syrian refugees and from many other countries flooding Europe. And the fact that in Brahms's time, he turned that into a source of lifelong inspiration, the music of the Hungarian folks that he met in Hamburg, means to me that perhaps there's an opportunity where we only see devastation and the incredible trouble that those refugees have today. But I hope that maybe out of that, that instead of clash of civilization, that we'll have beautiful music being created because of that meeting of civilizations. And so we're waiting for the Brahms of Europe to do that today.
So what's it like working with Yo-Yo Ma then?
Well, all these themes that we're talking about are in a way extra musical, though music is always coming from life experience for composers who are able to translate that life experience into sound. So all that to say, this piece is dealing with large themes, and no one does that better than Yo-Yo. That's been our experience. He is always zooming back and forth. In a way, I almost think of it as like a scientist who deals with the micro, you know, a cellular biologist, and he'll zoom in to a detail of the music like that, and then pan out and really talk about the incredibly large expanse of the universe. And I don't exaggerate. That is the scale that he believes music has. So, and seeing him do that on his instrument, the instrument as a vehicle for communication more than a vehicle for showing what the cello can do, you know. And just the way he embraces everyone in the room, whether that's with his instrument or without, no one is left out of that conversation. So obviously, starting from knowing Yo-Yo as we did from around 20 years ago almost, I was a kid just out of school, he's been one of the biggest musical forces in my life. And to be able to do this together at this moment is incredibly special.
Well, on that note, Eric, this is a high point. What do you do next? Where do you go from here?
Yeah, that's such a funny...
Retire.
Yeah, retire. This is our last show. No, it's so funny that you say that because I was thinking of the first time I heard Colin play with Yo-Yo. I remember my dad and I drove up from New York to Dartmouth College. This was close to 18 years ago or something. Maybe 20.
It was almost, yeah, 18 years.
Yeah. We got in a car and we drove up to Dartmouth because Colin was playing the Shostakovich trio, piano, violin, cello, with Yo-Yo at a concert, one of the first Silk Road concerts at Dartmouth College. And I thought that was it. That was it. That was the arrival point. Colin's on stage with Yo-Yo in a big theater and they're playing this incredible music. And I went out and saw the show, and I asked the same question, what do you do from here? What? There can't be anything more, right? That's it. And then a year later, I got to hear him play the Ravel Trio at Carnegie Hall, photo right over there, actually, with Yo-Yo, and that was then, oh, well, that's it. That's now it. That's, you know. And then 2, 3, 4, or 5 years later, I got to not hear him play the Brahms double with Yo-Yo and the New York Phil. And I was devastated because I wasn't able to be there because that was it, right? But no, there's always something else. And of course, we all scale things in different ways and something's important. And then this becomes the new thing that you're interested in being a part of in your life. And so what do? We just keep on making music and we keep on having great relationships and we bring new music, we bring old music and give it a place on stage and hopefully communicate with our audience.
So, Colin, I got to ask you this. When I talked to Eric, he talked about ping pong and the importance of ping pong. Sounds like you all had a bit of rivalry there.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, it all went down in the moron room, which is what our dad called the basement, where if we were getting rowdy, you know, that's where we would go. It had a ping pong table there. And when we would play ping pong, it was often a practice break. And then, you know, I was 4 years older, which now is nothing between us. But, you know, when you're 8 and 4 or whatever, is sizable on a ping pong table. So there would be some frustrations from Eric. And so there was a sacrificial paddle that wasn't used to hit the ball, but was used to throw. And we worked out a system where instead of him actually throwing it at me, he would say, I'm getting the paddle. And then I would just duck, and then he'd throw it. And so it was fine. You know, it was like, it was a way of channeling the aggression. But anyway, ping pong was a wonderful, basically, release and parallel thing as we were growing up to playing
playing our instruments. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you still play ping pong or any other sports to kind of let off steam?
Yeah, I still play. We both play ping pong and tennis still. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll say that our ages, as we all know, right, the older you get, the age gets closer together. And I really should at this point be able to beat my brother in ping pong, really, but I can't. I think it's part physical, like the act of playing ping pong, and I think it's part like Martian messaging ESP that he sends to me to have this this older brother power over me, and why I make those mistakes at crucial moments.
Sounds like you're a bit of a John McEnroe of the ping pong table.
It's funny, John McEnroe was definitely our father's favorite tennis player.
Oh, that's right.
And which was great, and yet I'm looking at this guy like, this isn't a role model, are we? But at the same time, you know, one of the greatest heroes and tennis players ever. Someone's I've actually met since and was a very nice guy.
In that meeting.
So what got you all into music? Were your parents musicians?
Yeah. Our dad played violin in the Metropolitan Opera for over 30 years, and our mom was a freelance flutist and teacher in the New York area. So that was, I mean, the main thing was really, I think, that they would invite friends over to our house just to play music for fun. And that would go on literally all night. And we were, as kids, oh, it's a party. Music is a party. And we were allowed to stay up late if we were just, you know, hanging out and listening. And so I think that idea of music as a joyous thing that brings people together was the message we had about what music meant and why we wanted to participate as soon as we could.
Is it a bit of a struggle to try and convey that to a broader audience, Eric? I mean, classical music can have a bit of a uptight image sometimes. So with your ensembles like Brooklyn Rider, The Knights, is that your way of trying to make sure that people know that there is this broad audience for music and it can be a party?
You know, I think what you point out is true. There's an idea of that classical music is, maybe it's a bubble of some sort. And I think anyone who does get in the seat of a concert, a well-performed and with an orchestra or a chamber group or whatever, that's really trying to communicate and finds a way to communicate, it's really hard, I think, for anyone then to walk away and say, oh, I wasn't touched by something. And of course, as we know, there's so many different levels of embracing a communication of music. Yes, of course, there are things that we need to change about the concert experience and the way we communicate with an audience with words and, you know, all those things that go into it. And we continue to really figure those things out, whether it's, you know, as a conductor, I try to speak from stage often because you kind of break down that thing of, oh, we're supposed to be quiet here and sit in the dark. At the same time, there is something so beautiful about being there and witnessing something as an audience member. I think everyone has a different desire to be involved or to witness something and how to find that middle ground. I think one of the most beautiful things for me about going to a concert, not performing, but going to see a concert, is the ability to both absorb the music as a human, as an individual, but also to shut down for a certain amount of time. And I don't mean to say, like, oh, well, music makes me go to sleep. That's not what I mean. Maybe it makes you think harder than you thought in 30 days because it's your first 2-hour session that you haven't had a phone in front of you for just a check-in for every 20 minutes or so.
And that was Eric Jacobson, the music director and conductor of the Orlando Philharmonic Orchestra, and his brother, violinist Colin Jacobson. That interview first aired on Intersection last May. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for this week's show from Juan Gualda and Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.